Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Our guest today, Johns Hopkins Bloomberg Distinguished Professor Lawrence Jackson, has devoted much of his career as an historian and author to uncovering lost details and reconstructing the lives of African Americans throughout history. One of those people is Frederick Douglass, whose 200th birthday is being observed this month on February 14th. Jackson teaches English and history at the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences and the Center for Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Next Saturday, February 10th, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, Jackson will present findings from the interactive map he and his students created of Frederick Douglass's time in Maryland. It explores the abolitionist leader's life in Baltimore and on the Eastern Shore where he was born. Welcome, Professor Jackson.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Where did the idea for a mapping project come from?
Well, like any good Baltimorean, you can't leave the city and then return and then have an interest in biography and not be just sort of taken by the figure of Frederick Douglass and also by Billie Holiday. And so I've become, you know, sort of deeply enmeshed in projects dealing with both figures.
Well, how does exploring the physical environment of an historical figure add to what we can understand about them?
It's absolutely transformative for me. When I was beginning my career, I was doing work on Ralph Ellison. Ellison was thought to have been, you know, really a New York Mandarin and somebody who flourished in artistic circles in the 40s and 50s and 60s in Manhattan. And that was his, you know, sort of primary nesting place. And what I did, I went to Oklahoma City where he'd grown up, and I was able to get Sanborn fire insurance maps, and I used to have them covering a wall of the house in the 4500 block of Pimlico Road in Baltimore. And, you know, just sort of through that process, I was able to really imagine just different networks of possibility for these people. I mean, of course, Ellison as a young person, and I wanted to be able to bring the same kind of granular detail to Frederick Douglass's life.
So you wanted to bring that to Douglass. Why? What is it about Douglass?
Sure. Like other celebrated black figures, Douglass tends to be known primarily for his life and work either in the UK or in Rochester or, you know, sort of on the abolitionist lecture circuit, but especially in New England and in other parts of the Northeast. And I really wanted to bring Douglass back to his roots and the place that really launched him. And what emerged was, you know, for me at least, was fairly remarkable given the place of contemporary biographical scholarship on Douglass. And in fact, the African-American community in Baltimore in the 1830s was not only remarkable, but it was an extraordinary hotbed of black abolitionism, black anti-colonialism, or, you know, the idea that African-Americans would, you know, Thomas Jefferson wanted everybody to sort of get on a boat and go back to Africa, but that you had actually a vibrant black intellectual and religious community, and Douglass participated actively in it for the many years that he lived in the city.
That's Johns Hopkins Professor Lawrence Jackson here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his work researching and mapping Frederick Douglass's time in Maryland. He'll present his findings at an event in honor of Douglass's 200th birthday next Saturday, February 10th, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. What did you and your students find out about where Douglass spent his time and what he did?
Well, Douglass was known to have lived in three places in Fells Point, sort of south of modern-day Eastern Avenue, which was Wilkes Street at that time. And what we noticed as we started to look very closely at an 1851 map and then what comes up really beautifully in an 1869 very, very detailed map of the city and city structures was that Douglass was a stone's throw, really, at almost all of his dwellings. He was a stone's throw from these sort of these major conduits of black entrepreneurial, religious, and intellectual centers of life. It's well known that Douglass became a caulker, started studying the caulker's trade, you know, when he was...
A ship's caulker. Caulking ships.
That's correct. When he was, you know, maybe 12 years old or so, he was owned by a man whose brother was a shipbuilder. And he probably began to apprentice, you know, fairly early. But certainly by the time he was an adult man, about 18 years old, he was working every day as a calker, as were perhaps four dozen other African-Americans, men who were heads of households. In fact, the oldest buildings that are in existence in Fells Point today are thought to have been the homes of black calkers. They're wooden frame houses on Wolf Street. But this Wolf Street locus is actually quite remarkable because several people that Douglas mentioned specifically as being friends of his lived on Wolf Street, black calkers, and they were also sort of, you know, catacorner or almost next door neighbors to men who were seamen. And it is believed that Douglas got the seaman's papers of a man named Stanley, and there was a Jeremiah Stanley, again, sort of living at the corner of Wolf Street and Wilk Street. So
let me just interject to make sure people understand. When you say he got the seaman's papers, he used those to make his escape, correct?
Exactly. This is how Douglas was able to outwit the slave catcher and to take a train to freedom. And he needed those identification papers to prove that he was a freeman. And of course, he was masquerading as a freeman. And the person who lent him the papers, you know, did so at great risk, great peril of, you know, possibly being imprisoned, fined, and of course, you know, always with the possibility of being re-enslaved or enslaved himself.
As I listen to you describe some of the physical connections or proximities that you can trace from these maps and where Frederick Douglass would have been, it strikes me as all the more amazing that he could have escaped because he would have been so well known. He had so many connections, not just among African Americans, but among whites.
Sure.
In Baltimore.
He talks about this, you know, in the narrative that is produced in 1881 and then in 1893, that during the course of the escape, I mean, he is running into people again and again and again, black and white, who knew him and had seen him, you know, sort of at work on the docks or knew him going in and around Baltimore. And there were so many places where Douglas himself, you know, was possibly could have been exposed and would have been, you know, very likely not just returned to Baltimore, but sold further south. And it's also important to remember that Harriet Tubman says the same thing, that over and over again, she was almost sort of discovered as a person who was leading these runaways out. But both of those figures, I mean, both of these Marylanders, I mean, they were just tremendously courageous people. And that spirit is what enabled them to persevere and to triumph.
As you just alluded, Douglass wrote several autobiographies. We know a fair amount from his own account of his life as a slave. So what is it that your research with this mapping, what does it add to what we know about Douglass?
Sure. I'm really curious to be able to learn more about and to share what I'm finding with the broad public about the community that produced and shaped Douglass's experience, especially here in Maryland and in Baltimore. I think that, you know, there's a flaw that we sometimes want to look at the or create the exceptional figure, the one person against the odds, the single person who was somehow able to triumph against enslavement, who was able to, you know, sort of survive the famine, who was able to be the solo figure who made it through the war unscathed. But I think that it's it makes better sense and is more useful to us, especially with some of our contemporary problems, if we look at these broader communities that actually enabled one person to become the symbol for a kind of a flourishing that was shared widely. Let me just say something about one person in particular. We had here in the city in the 1820s and 1830s a man named William Watkins. And Watkins ran a school connected to the Sharp Street Methodist Church and was a very prominent abolitionist, someone whose writings influenced William Lloyd Garrison. Typically, the relationship is between Douglas and Garrison is always understood as, you know, Garrison, the mentor who brought the ex-slave, the mildly literate ex-slave, along and enabled him to develop an international reputation. And I think it's important for us to understand that you had so many African-Americans. Daniel Coker is another one in the African Methodist Episcopal tradition, who were not only developing their own talents, but were sharing what they knew and their important political points of view with people who would become prominent figures in the abolitionist movement. And so I think also the exceptionally rich heritage here in the city, I mean, it just needs to be brought out more.
Right as we started, you mentioned returning to Baltimore. You returned here in 2016 to your hometown after 14 years teaching at Emory University in Atlanta. What is the personal impact of this research for you?
One of the things that I really enjoyed about working on this project is the building up my own Baltimore pride and sense of being a native. Typically, Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, you know, sort of our nearby cousins, have pride of place relative to the accomplishments in Black history. Philadelphia, for example, known as the place of Richard Allen and the African-American Methodist Episcopal Church. Washington, D.C. as the place that hosts such a large, vibrant, and successful African-American middle class. But in the early 19th century, the largest number of Black freed people, urban freed people, was actually in Baltimore City because manumissions in Maryland were outpacing the numbers of people who were enslaved. And in Baltimore, some exceptional things were possible. One of the other fascinating dimensions about our city that doesn't get enough recognition is that unlike some other places in the United States, Charleston, South Carolina, and New Orleans, Louisiana, there was no solid skin color hierarchy in Baltimore among African Americans. In fact, one of the figures I've already mentioned, Daniel Coker, who was an important AME bishop, one of the first AME bishops, he couldn't serve as the head of the National Church because people thought he was too light-skinned. And so there did not emerge in Baltimore the same kind of colorist class, social class hierarchies and distinctions that in some ways were very cruel and limited mobility for Black people in other areas. So Baltimore also had the distinction of being a democratic place where it was your talent which enabled you to rise.
Your most recent book is a biography of African-American novelist Chester B. Hymes, which sheds lights on his place as a pioneer of Black writing. What's your next project?
That's a great question. I really would actually like to write a book about Holiday's life. And we're working
Billie
on...
Billie Holiday,
that's right. We're working on Holiday in class this semester. I have two classes who will devote themselves tirelessly, along with their professor, you know, to sort of digging up the Baltimore past of Billie Holiday, whose family's, both sides of her family, they were from Baltimore and from Virginia. I am convinced that the sound that we hear when Holiday sings, she's often given credit for her special jazz virtuosic phrasing, but that the actual sound of her voice is one that we would trace to this region, and that that is a part of what makes it very special, very poignant, very soulful, I would say. But I would like to think long and hard about doing some extended work on Billie Holiday.
I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it.
I would like to do so. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Lawrence Jackson is Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of English and History at Johns Hopkins. We've been talking about his project researching and mapping Frederick Douglass's years in Maryland. He'll present his findings at an event in honor of Douglass's 200th birthday next Saturday, February 10th at 12:30 at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, 830 East Pratt Street in Baltimore. We have a link to that and other events commemorating Douglass's birth at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. After a break, a special Stoop story by the great-great-granddaughter of Frederick Douglass. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.